It's Wednesday, February 7th, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as always, are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Memo Madness, the release of the Nunez memo, the Democratic response. What did any of it accomplish? Do we know anything we didn't know before? And should we have been surprised to find out the conservative networks got a sneak peek? PolitiFact said that it was adding two reader reps to its team, one Republican, one Democrat. Why has it already fired the Democrat? And it's prime movie-going season, which has made the new ticket app MoviePass gain in popularity. $10 a month to see as many movies as you want. Sounds too good to be true. Is it? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up, but let's start with the swift and somewhat mysterious firing of the managerial staff at Newsweek. Mind you, today's Newsweek isn't what many of us remember from a decade or two ago, but the news magazine is still producing fresh content for its web-only edition. On Monday, the editor-in-chief and executive editor and two senior writers, not there anymore, and at least one other person has at this point quit in solidarity. It was a pretty swift action that was unexpected, some are saying, an act of retaliation.
Well, and the reason some are saying that is because Newsweek and the International Business Times are owned by a company called IBT Media, and a lot of journalists from different publications have found connections between that company and a church in California run by a leader. It's called, some people think it's a cult. And that's only one of the problems at Newsweek. They've also had sexual harassment charges filed against one of the former editors there. And they've had all kinds of other questions about fraudulent purchasing of audiences to try to ramp up their advertising rates. So there's a lot of bad stuff happening right
now. Yeah, and I think one of the things that sort of came out of this was that you had reporters and editors at Newsweek that were trying to cover the story, and the owners were like, you know, we just can't have you covering these kinds of stories about us and then putting it out there because, you know, we're already looking bad and we don't need to sort of pile on. But, I mean, I think the serious charges that's going on here is the sexual harassment charges and the financial charges, which are sort of working their way through. And the problem with Newsweek from the time that it was sold to this company has been it's sort of lost its news edge. It's moving more toward sort of soft news pieces and that sort of thing.
And so news and clickbait too. Clickbait. A lot of curated clickbait.
And so you've had people who have either left the company on their own or who have been asked to leave because they're not following along with this sort of change to soft news, clickbait, things that are just going to draw people's eyes. And then on top of that, you've got this investigation that's being done by other news outlets and those journalists in there. And they just said, you know, enough is enough.
And the reason this should matter to anybody beyond people in the media is because this company, IBT Media, actually has something like 40 million plus users around the world for a variety of publications in a variety of different languages. And those publications, not Newsweek, are frankly the ones that are generating money and perhaps having a pretty big influence on the coverage in some of those other places.
You know, and it could be one of those situations where, you know, what, as you said at the beginning, what we know as Newsweek is not what Newsweek is now. And maybe they're trying to position it to sell it off, maybe to someone who can revive Newsweek, or they're just gonna shut it down.
Still seems kind of odd to me, though, that they would move in that quickly with their own journalists and just basically fire them. Then there were a few resignations that came in support of that, not telling anybody on the staff what was going on, still not really acknowledging any of the reasons.
And some of the reporters are still there saying, hey, this story is still there and we want to do it. And they're being discouraged not to do that story. It's like, you really don't want to touch this.
You can understand, though, why any company would not, any journalistic operation would not really want its own reporters covering its own dirty laundry. This is a problem that comes up all the time. It just happens to be highlighted here because Newsweek is a legacy brand name that a lot of people are still familiar
with. Right.
Okay, well, we do have a handful of other inside baseball type of topics to bring up today. All the inner workings going on at newspapers and magazines across the country. The next one that I want to bring up is what's going on at the Los Angeles Times. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about how the staff there had voted to unionize. And Ernest, 2 weeks ago, you were bringing this up and saying, you know, there may not be a whole lot to talk about. And you suggested Monday that we bring this back up. And since Monday, the entire story has developed and changed in new ways.
It's changed in a lot of ways.
Trunk confirming this morning, the Washington Post story from yesterday evening at dinner time, that there is a deal in place to sell the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah, and it's almost like you could see this coming. I mean, you know, even the owners...
As someone who used to work there, you could see this coming from 2000 to today. But go ahead.
Right, but the owners... basically were saying after the union vote that they were willing to talk to the employees who had voted to start this union, but that it was going to have to be under some certain terms. It was, and you could sort of see it moving this way. It's almost like they were looking for someone to please come and take this off our hands. We don't want to deal with this. And they've had issues with the Los Angeles Times, and a lot of it revolves around the fact that Trunk is more Midwest, East Coast centered, and the LA Times is out on the left coast, on the West Coast, and it's one of those things where the LA Times just did not fit in with what Trunk or Tribune Company, the way in which they operate a newspaper, and even in the way in which they produce and distribute their news.
And that's something, again, like I say, that's been going on since it was acquired as part of the Times Mirror acquisition going back to early 2000. Interestingly enough, the person who is said to be buying the paper and also the San Diego Union-Tribune as part of that, a large stakeholder in Trunk, somebody who owns a pretty good number of shares in that company.
Well, and somebody who's pretty controversial in his own right. I mean, his name is Patrick Soon-Shiong, and some people say he calls himself the richest doctor in the world, and he's made claims about how he was going to solve the healthcare crisis, and he was going to win the war on cancer and a lot of things like that that haven't endeared him necessarily with the scientific community. But he is a Los Angeles business owner, and there's been a lot of talk about whether or not having local ownership of the LA Times would make a difference, which I think we've, over the years when it's been discussed and lots of other potential buyers we thought were coming forward, it was a good idea to have local ownership there. I don't know if that will make a difference now, given all of the stuff that's happened, not the least of which was this interesting story that you were sharing with us about an attempt by Trunk before they sold to create this second sort of news operation within the LA Times building. Was a non-union shop, and a lot of the folks working for the paper didn't even know it was there.
Yeah, there's an interesting piece that you can read in depth on our links blog from the Huffington Post that looked at how there was an additional subsidiary created that was beginning to take on the appearance of a shadow newsroom that would have been non-union, not all that much unlike what Michael Farrow had done when he was at the helm of Rapports in Chicago with the Chicago Sun-Times and the shadow newsroom that covered some of its national content.
Yeah, what's going to be interesting for me to look at with the LA Times is it going to become a sort of community newspaper? And the problem that the LA Times has had, even going back to when the Chandlers owned it, mm-hmm. was being able to connect all of these diverging communities. And there's a story on our links blog done by the New York Times.
Yeah, The double disc,
which sort of looks at how difficult it is because of the way in which Los Angeles is now and has been for a long time, difficult to try to bring all those diverging communities together. And now you have this situation where not only did he buy the LA Times, but he also bought the San Diego Union Tribune. Mm-hmm. And now there's this talk about trying to merge the two, especially in light of the fact that the Union Tribune is printed by the LA Times, and there's supposed to be some sort of sharing of content. And they're only separated by 120 miles, but there's a lot of difference between what people in San Diego expect in their news and what people in the divergent Los Angeles community expect in theirs.
You mentioned, Amy, the double disc, and I really think folks, if they haven't had a chance to read it yet, they should go to our links blog and check out that LA Times article, and of course all of the comments from Los Angelinos complaining about it, because the New York Times story basically was, well, you know, out there in LA, it's too widely dispersed, and everybody just looks over their own fence. They don't care about the big city. They don't have enough charitable contributions. All these problems. And, you know, the New York Times, of course, is this big East Coast city where everything is just perfect, I'm sure.
And they all get together and they all single. It's kind of funny.
And again, one of the other jokes that was brought up with it, if you'll remember, I don't know, is it a couple months ago, a couple of years? I lose track of time. But the New York Times had done that piece talking about putting peas in guacamole. Like, that this was like the biggest, like, New York is way too into itself since it talked about peas and guac.
Right.
So. We're going to make our way eastward as we talk about some of these other stories. So the next one that we're going to talk about is coming from inside the newsroom at the Las Vegas Review-Journal. By now, we all know that Las Vegas casino magnate Steve Wynn has stepped down from his role as RNC finance chair amid claims of sexual conduct. Also, since I wrote this script yesterday, he's also stepped down as the head of his own company, Wynn Inc., again, because of claims of sexual misconduct. What we didn't know is that there had been, before this story had been come out this week, this longstanding pattern of behavior involving him in the Las Vegas hotels and casinos. And the Las Vegas Review-Journal had a record of it, had been reporting on it, and spiked the story 20 years ago. What is the explanation that the Las Vegas Review-Journal is giving for having spiked the story?
Well, so... At the time, there were a couple of different workers at the hotel that Wynn was managing, not his own, who were claiming sexual harassment, saying that they were told that they were to have sex with high-rolling gamblers, that Wynn himself had hit on one of them. And the paper required them to come in and take a lie detector test with the reporter who was working on the story and the publisher of the paper present. And after that happened, we don't know exactly what the results were of the lie detector test, but then they spiked the story. And the reporter, who's now an editor at the paper, held on to all the documentation, saying, well, I've always wanted to tell their story. It just seems kind of odd to me that it took the Wall Street Journal and the Me Too movement, all these other things that happened before she came forward with the story.
Yeah, and it's also fitting that Adelson and Wynn are...
Yeah, so that was going to be the next thing I was going to
throw in. You know, our rivals in the casino business in that area, and now that he's bought this paper, all of a sudden his story comes out. But they're saying that, I mean, according to the current editor, he's saying that the owner,
Sheldon Adelson,
didn't read the story until everyone else read the story when it came out on, I think it was Sunday morning.
I don't know, Mike, so, you're making the face.
No, I mean, I think that's...
Maybe you don't buy it.
No, I think that's definitely a factor that we need to consider. But what I still don't really understand, and I wish we'd get more of an explanation from the principals involved, even 20 years ago, let alone today, a lie detector test for sources, why would you do that and decide on the veracity of... your sources based largely on that?
Well, technology. You know, I was reading something on this because I was concerned about that myself. And apparently after the whole National Enquirer, when they lost that big lawsuit, a lot of the Hollywood, the sort of and Variety, sort of those type of publications had gone to that method. So this may have been something that 20 years ago they put, because this was around the time of the National Enquirer, they may have pulled that idea from them.
Okay. Well, we're going to head east again, this time to Austin, Texas, where the management at Texas Monthly is adding a position many newsrooms have eliminated in the past few years, the ombudsman. This is being done in reaction to some criticism that was thrown its way about a story that was done about the dating app Bumble.
So it turns out that the young woman who's founded Bumble, company that may now be worth north of $1 billion, was being featured as part of a story in Texas Monthly about new Texas innovators. And apparently the editor of Texas Monthly decided to put her on the cover of the magazine, possibly, if the email suggests this anyway, because she agreed to spend $25,000, $30,000 of her own money on a social media campaign to drive traffic to the article.
Right, and of course the Texas Monthly is known for its journalistic integrity. So the journalists and even a lot of the freelancers that work for it basically said, "Whoa, wait a minute! You can't do this.
This is not who
and
we
this
are.
This is not who we are. We have to maintain our journalistic integrity. When you bought the company, you promised you were going to do this, and so now the editor and the owner are basically saying we need to bring in an ombudsman to make sure that we're following along through this." And integrity. So they've brought in Rich Oppel, who is a former editor of the Austin American Statesman, well-known, high-integrity journalist, not only in Texas but throughout the country, to be this ombudsman, look at their operations, look at their ethical standards to make a determination as to how they move forward.
It's also interesting to me, this sort of conversation these days about what kind of credential you have to be a major editor at a legacy news operation. I mean, for example, the guy that's there now, who wrote the questionable emails, came from the University of Texas, where he managed the alumni publication there. He wasn't a sort of a hardcore journalist like the folks who were in charge of Texas Monthly before. We had similar questions about, you know, before he was fired for sexual misconduct, the editor at the Los Angeles Times.
Exactly.
And so, but what does it take, you know, to be, what credential do you have for your employees to trust that you're going to do the right thing?
Okay. Our last stop, again, on that west to east voyage, the headquarters of the fact-checking site PolitiFact. In an effort to attract skeptical readers, the PolitiFact team announced it would hire two reader reps, bringing on two former Florida congressmen, David Jolly and Alan Grayson, to critique and critique the fact checkers' own work. Jolly is a Republican, Alan Grayson a Democrat. Jolly still has his job, and Grayson has been fired. Okay, that was probably the biggest oversimplification of a complicated situation ever. Why isn't Grayson there anymore?
Well, so first of all, I'm going to just up front tell you, I have a relationship with Aaron Schirachman, who is the editor of PolitiFact. He's worked with us and our students on projects. The Missouri School of Journalism is basically PolitiFact Missouri. We do all of the content for them.
And so I've met with him and had conversations too. Both of us have had.
Yeah. But here's the thing. So PolitiFact has for a long time been concerned about how it's just preaching to the choir, basically, of mostly left-of-center readers who really appreciate fact-checking, especially when you're fact-checking the questionable statements of Republicans. But Aaron wanted to try to get beyond that echo chamber, so he's been out there doing all kinds of things, having some town hall meetings in some cities in right-leaning states, trying to get feedback, and now he's got this plan to have a Democrat and a Republican looking over their shoulder and giving context and feedback. All well and good, but I don't know if Republican and Democratic former congressmen are really what you'd call reader representatives. And so that's part of the debate.
When they first announced that they were going to do this, that was my question. I mean, I understand that you want to make sure that you're being, you know, to use this loosely, fair across the board when you're doing this political fact checking. But to bring in congressmen to do that, I don't quite understand why would you go in that direction as opposed to maybe bringing one person in from a, say, a left-leaning think tank and another person in from a right-leaning think tank and have them probably do it. I mean, I just saw that as problematic.
Something that might be considered a little bit more, as we teach our reporting students, a third-party validator, somebody who doesn't necessarily have a horse in the race an agenda to put forward themselves.
I don't even object to them having these members of Congress do it, as long as that's not the only thing they're doing. But the problem, as you alluded, they got rid of one of the two congressmen before they even wrote anything, and that's because, well, the stated reason in the coverage in Pointer and some other places is that they found out that he was going to be running or considering running for statewide office in Florida, and that was a deal killer. You can't be running for office and critiquing coverage, fact-checking of politicians.
But I find it also, what I found unusual is that they still haven't named
a successor,
you know, and it's been a couple of weeks.
And that's a part that is mildly troublesome to me. If this idea is to bring in skeptical readers, if you're going to do that for the sake of creating that fairness and having someone from the right and from the left, right now you only have that person from the right.
Right.
I have not talked to him, so I have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. But they have two Florida congressmen because PolitiFact is headquartered
Based in Tampa.
I don't know if they're trying to find somebody from the congressional delegation or former congressman from Florida, or whether they're looking beyond that.
Okay. So who knew the madness that could come from a four-page memo? Really, we saw it last week with the release of the Nunez memo on Friday morning. In it, allegations that the FBI abused its surveillance authority to target a former foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign. It also got into detail on the Russia case. It was kind of funny, though, how Fox News and the Washington Examiner, they had it on the air and online and were talking about the details while everybody else was still trying to read through the first couple sentences.
I don't think anybody was surprised. I mean, Nunez has always had a close relationship with the right-leaning publications and media outlets, so the fact that they got the story first is not surprising. What surprises me about all of this is that, you know, a lot of it was being leaked even early before it came out. So why all the circus centering around it when you know this is? I mean, it's sort of like even though you know it's going to be headed in this direction. Let's sort of pile on while the getting's good. And now it's started with the fact that, okay, we're going to let the Democrats memo come out, but oh wait a minute, maybe President Trump's going to decide not to release that. So now the circus continues. So, again, it's the shiny bauble thing mm-hmm. that I keep talking about. We're paying attention to this, and we still got this budget situation going on over here that still has yet to be resolved.
24 hours from now, we could be right back into that situation where we're looking at another shutdown. Right. What were you going to say, Mike?
No, a related thing that's really interesting to me is the level of coordination that probably went on with the whole leaking of the Republican memo first, because you remember there was a partisan vote in the committee, the House Intelligence Committee, to release the Republican memo, but not to release the Democratic memo right. that was skeptical of it. And now, after that whole campaign has gone on for more than a week of release the memo, and bots being involved and all kinds of sophisticated strategy to really ramp up that meme, now that it's out there and a lot of folks have bought into the Republican narrative, now all of a sudden the committee votes, well, sure, let's release the Democratic memo. Now, the president may redact some parts of it, but sure, we're happy with being transparent. After the campaign to get the memo out there, the first one.
I mean, to me, the problem I see with all of this is that an investigative process on a serious matter has now become so political and so partisan that we're not even really getting to what exactly was going on. And my fear is that once we move out of this sort of partisan cycle, how are we going to be able to bring that back to say, wait a minute, let's have these investigations that matter and get to some facts and information that can help our democracy.
He said, once we get out of the partisan cycle, when is that going to happen?
give me a heads up when that happens. Okay. February means one thing. Football's over, and before baseball starts, we got people who are watching a whole lot of movies, gearing up for Oscar weekend, and it seems that in the last few weeks, a new app has taken off, one that will, for a $10 a month subscription, allow you to go to the movies as often as once a day, and they pay for the ticket when you check in at a movie theater using their mobile app. The business model is a bit of a head-scratcher. Here's the CEO trying to explain it to CNN's Frank Pelota.
We're buying one in every 35 tickets sold in the United States. So in a short 5 months, we're buying, you know, a ton of movie tickets.
So how is this a thing?
It's kind of like you're losing money with every new subscriber. How is this a viable business plan?
Whenever you offer an all-you-can-eat program, the first couple months, people go crazy. People want to see every movie that comes out. You know, eventually you're going to get back to a normal level. The reality is, people are going a lot more than they used to, but it's not as much as you would imagine.
What's the catch?
The catch is that over time, you're going to get offers and proposals from us, you know, buying the soundtrack of the movie as you walk out of the theater. Making money off of giving you ideas that you might be interested in.
So there are some other catches too. The app is not good at all showings, some of those like Saturday night showings you may not be able to get into. And there are some movie theater chains, AMC in particular, that are not fans of the app, not making it available for use in their theaters.
So, and that's part of the business model that he wasn't talking about, at least in that clip, which is that once we get enough subscribers to where we have leverage with the big movie theater companies like AMC, we can go at them and say, hey, now we want a little piece of the action on those ticket sales too. And that's something that AMC is worried about, because at the moment they had the monopoly of selling, you know, $10, $12, $15 a person tickets. Now they're trying to compete with $9.99 a month or whatever.
Right, and the other part to that is that how can these movie theaters not sell the tickets to this company. I mean, they're buying them outright at face value. And if they're setting it up to where they're allowing their subscribers to actually use those tickets, there's not really any way they can get around that. But, and it goes back to what you're saying, now they have that leverage. Now they can say, hey, you know, we may be buying a ticket, but you're getting the popcorn, you're getting the drinks, you're getting the food, which is at
the concessions
have the high
profit
exactly
margin.
Exactly, and we want to cut in that, or you know, we may decide to do it, go in another direction.
Okay, before we go, we've got to talk just for a minute or two about Sunday night's Super Bowl broadcast. Ratings were down a bit from the past few years. NBC had that technical glitch that resulted in about 30 seconds of dead air. And the commercials were, for the most part, pretty meh. The Tide commercials got a lot of buzz, mainly for the bite-sized segments, no pun intended. But the ad that most people are talking about, that one for the Dodge Ram featuring the words of Martin Luther King.
If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. By giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great. You don't have to know about Plato and Aristotle to serve. You don't have to know the theory of relativity to serve.
It was poignant, but at the same time pretty tone deaf if you go to read on the full speech to know that it's about the ills of consumerism.
I was watching this ad when it came out. I was working, but also watching the game. And when it started, I was going like, because I remember the speech, and I'm looking at it, I'm going like, what is it? What is it? And then I saw the truck, and I'm like, I cannot believe that they did this. I cannot believe that Dodge allowed whatever ad company they hired to do this, and then they put it on the air. You don't take a speech like this from someone like MLK and try to sell a truck with it. I'm sorry, you just don't do that.
Yeah, they want at least one step too far. You see some of these issue-oriented ads or feel-good ads with companies trying to show solidarity, you know, or with immigrants or whatever it might be, but they're not showing a shot of the truck every 5 or 10 seconds in the ad. It's not so in your face. So that seemed to be a little bit too much.
The organization that owns the rights, if you will, to MLK's words, his speeches, his images, they approved the ad,
though family members
came out against it after the fact.
They've done this before. They sort of sit back, they allow it to happen, and then when it goes bad, which it always does, then they say, well, we're not for it. It drives me crazy.
Okay, well, that music means we are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about on today's show on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Austin Howard and John Saltzman are our associate producers. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.